I'd like to begin this morning by telling you a story, the story of Gary Cohn. This first bit will be a direct quote from a book that I read about underdogs, and it's a really fascinating story. Gary Cohn grew up in a suburb of Cleveland in Northeast Ohio. His family was in the electrical contracting business, and this was in the 70s, a time before dyslexia was routinely diagnosed. He was held back a year in elementary school because he couldn't read. But he said, "I didn't do any better the second time than I did the first time." He had a discipline problem. "I sort of got expelled from elementary school," he explained. "I think when you hit the teacher, you get expelled. It was one of those disruptive incidents. I was being abused. The teacher put me under her desk and rolled her chair in and started kicking me. So I pushed the chair back, hit her in the face, and I walked out. I was in the fourth grade." He called that period in his life the ugly years. His parents didn't know what to do. "It was probably the most frustrating part of my life," which is saying a lot. He went on, "because it wasn't that I wasn't trying. I was working really, really hard. And no one understood that part of the equation. They literally thought that I was conscientiously making decisions to be a disruptive kid, to not learn, to hold the class back. You know what it's like. You're a 6 or 7 or 8 year old kid and you're in a public school setting and everyone thinks you're an idiot. So you try to do funny things to try to create some sort of social esteem. You try to get up every morning and say, 'Today is going to be better.' But after you do that a couple of years, you realize that today is going to be no different than yesterday. And I'm going to have to struggle to get through, and I'm going to struggle to survive another day, and we'll see what happens." His parents took him from school to school trying to find something that worked. "All my mother wanted me to do was graduate high school," he says. "I think if you asked her, she'd have said, 'The happiest day of my life will be if he graduates high school. Then he can go drive a truck, but at least he'll have a high school degree.'" On the day he finally did graduate, Cohn's mother was a fountain of tears. "I've never seen anyone cry so much in my life," he said. When Gary Cohn was 22, he got a job selling aluminum siding and window frames for U.S. Steel in Cleveland. He had just graduated from American University after a middling academic career. One day, just before Thanksgiving, while visiting the company's sales office in Long Island, he persuaded his manager to give him the day off, and he ventured down to Wall Street. A few summers earlier, he'd been an intern at a local brokerage firm and had become interested in trading. He headed to the Commodities Exchange, which was part of the old World Trade Center complex. "I think I'm going to get a job," he said, "but there's nowhere to go. It's all secure. So I go up to the observation deck and I watch the guys and I think, 'Can I talk to them?' Then I walk down to the floor with the security gate and I stand at the security gate like someone's going to let me in. Of course, no one is. And then literally right after the market's closed, I see this pretty well-dressed guy running off the floor yelling to his clerk, 'I've got to go. I'm running to LaGuardia. I'm late. I'll call you when I get to the airport.' And I jump in the elevator and I say, 'I hear you're going to LaGuardia.' He says, 'Yeah.' I say, 'Can we share a cab?' He says, 'Sure.' I think this is awesome. With Friday afternoon traffic, I can spend the next hour in the taxi getting a job." The stranger Cohn had jumped into the cab with happened to be high up at one of Wall Street's big brokerage firms. And just that week, the firm had opened a business buying and selling options. The guy was running the options business but did not know what an option was, Cohn went on. He was laughing at the audacity of it all. "I lied to him all the way to the airport. When he said, 'Do you know what an option is?' I said, 'Of course I do. I know everything. I can do anything for you.' Basically, by the time we got out of the taxi, I had his number, and he said, 'Call me Monday.' So I called him Monday, flew back to New York on Tuesday or Wednesday, had an interview, and started working the next Monday. In that period of time, I read Macmillan's Options as a Strategic Investment book. It's like the Bible of options trading. It wasn't easy, of course, since Cohn estimates that on a good day it takes him 6 hours to read 22 pages. He buried himself in the book, working his way through one word at a time, repeating sentences until he was sure he understood them. When he started at work, he was ready. I literally stood behind him and said, 'Buy those, sell those, sell those.' Cohn said. I never owned up to him what I did. Or maybe he figured it out, but he didn't care. I made him tons of money. Cohn isn't ashamed of his beginnings on Wall Street, but it would be a mistake at the same time to say he's proud of them. He's smart enough to know that a story about bluffing your way into your first job isn't altogether flattering. He told it instead in the spirit of honesty. It was, "This is who I am." Cohn was required in that taxi ride to play a role, to pretend to be an experienced options trader when in fact he was not. Most of us would have foundered in that situation. We aren't used to playing someone other than ourselves. But Cohn had been playing someone other than himself since elementary school. You know what it's like. You're a 6 or 7 or 8 year old kid, and you're in a public school setting, and everyone thinks you're an idiot, so you try to do funny things to create some social esteem. Better to play the clown than to be thought of as an idiot. And if you've been pretending to be someone else your whole life, how hard is it to bluff your way through a 1 hour cab ride to LaGuardia? More importantly, most of us wouldn't have jumped in that cab because we would have worried about the potential social consequences. The Wall Street guy could have seen right through us and told everyone else on Wall Street, there's a kid out there posing as an options trader. Where would we be then? We could get tossed out of the cab. We could go home and realize options trading is way over our heads. We could show up on Monday morning and make a fool out of ourselves. We could get found out a week or a month later and get fired. Jumping in that cab was a disagreeable act, and most of us are inclined to be agreeable. But Cohn, he was selling aluminum siding. His mother thought he'd be lucky to end up a truck driver. He'd been kicked out of schools, dismissed as an idiot, and even as an adult, it took him 6 hours to read 22 pages because he had to work his way word by word to make sure he understood what he was reading. He had nothing to lose. My upbringing allowed me to be comfortable with failure, he said. The one trait in a lot of dyslexic people I know is by the time we get out of college, our ability to deal with failure is very highly developed. And so we look at most situations and see much more of the upside than the downside. Because we're so accustomed to the downside, it doesn't faze us. I've thought about it many times, I really have, because it defined who I am. I wouldn't be where I am today without my dyslexia. I never would have taken that chance. And so in the case of Gary Cohn, it turns out he was a really good trader. And it turns out that learning how to deal with the possibility of failure is really good preparation for a career in the business world. Today, he's president of Goldman Sachs. To be clear, this entire story was quoted very nearly verbatim from a book entitled David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants by Malcolm Gladwell. I highly recommend the entire book. Does that story sound like a movie? It could easily be one, right? What is it about this story, do you think, that makes it so compelling? I wonder if you would all agree with my assessment that we all seem to really enjoy rooting for the underdog. It seems to be ingrained in the human character. In fact, did you know that a surprisingly large percentage of entrepreneurs are, in fact, dyslexic? A study by City University of London puts the number as high as 1/3 of entrepreneurs. Some prominent examples that you may recognize their names: Richard Branson of Virgin Records and Virgin Atlantic Airways, Charles Schwab of the investment firm, Craig McCaw, I didn't recognize his name, but apparently he was a pioneer in the cell phone business, David Neeleman founded a company called JetBlue, John Chambers is the CEO of Cisco, Paul Orfalea was the founder of Kinko's. These are just a few names to point this out. So now, let's turn to the Bible. Can you think of any examples in the Bible of underdog stories? Go ahead, make a quick mental list. Think about a few. A brief list I made would include David and Goliath. I think that jumps out, obviously. But also, I thought of Joseph. I thought of Esther. I thought of Gideon. And if you have any additional suggestions, absolutely talk to me afterwards. Brethren, the reason we're directing our attention here today is to explore our role as underdogs in this present evil age and how that might be a source of encouragement to us. For it's a blessing and a benefit that will reap for us far greater rewards in the age to come. Over the next part of an hour, we'll look at David's willingness to fight Goliath, Gideon's willingness to lead 300 men against an army of hundreds of thousands, Joseph's patience and faith throughout his early life, even when he was enslaved and imprisoned, and how each of these examples can teach us the value of learning the lessons of the underdog. One of the reasons these stories are there for us is that we need to recognize our inadequacies and our reliance on our Father for guidance, for strength, for insight. David not only was a great example of extreme faith, he also exemplified the depth of human failing and fleshly weakness. And we would suggest that he also possessed the ability to forgive himself for his failings and to not withdraw from God. I don't know if you struggle as I do, but I know that I have at times felt so very unworthy that it feels hypocritical to even pray to God for forgiveness. And if my trivial little sins can bring me so low, how would I feel if I had sent a man to his death solely to hide my guilt and my transgressions? The story of Gideon carries within it a warning about weakness of faith and questioning God. God has the matter in hand always, well before we even have a clue just what his plan might be. And the story of Joseph has so many lessons. For example, even in a situation where you cannot see God, he is certainly working with and through us. We can see in the story an entreaty to maintain faith and to continue to look for ways in which we might be of service. We can see a reminder to not doubt, to not question God's path for us, to not give up hope, but rather to live with the hand we are dealt and to wait upon the Lord. Consider a very young David shepherding in the fields. What lessons did he learn from watching his sheep? We don't have much experience with the herding of sheep these days, but we know sheep are pretty calm and docile. We might imagine the biggest challenge a shepherd would face would be just to keep them together and out of trouble. But we learn from David in 1 Samuel that there are larger things to worry about. 1 Samuel, the 17th chapter, verses 34 and 35. David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him. I attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and I struck and killed him." Can you imagine facing a lion or a bear by yourself out in the fields? There's no armor. There's no gun. Only your hands, your feet, maybe a club or a sling. I would be up the nearest tree the minute I heard the sound of a bear or a lion. And yet David, presumably younger than 20 years old, went after them, struck and killed them in order to rescue his sheep. For some perspective, I recall hiking up in the Sierras in California, in the vicinity of Yosemite National Park. I'm pretty sure it was with Brother Bob Wilson a number of years ago. And I recall rounding a bend in the path, and I saw a large bull standing maybe 40 yards away, just looking at me. He didn't seem agitated or angry, but I was completely on edge. Bulls are big. There's something about being behind a fence that doesn't make them seem so big, but when he's right in front of you and there's no fence, he seemed a lot bigger. And even though we don't think of them as attack animals, they could do a lot of damage to one of us very easily. I was so afraid he would charge me, I had to force myself to keep calm and just keep walking down that path. And if a bull made me feel like that, I can only imagine what a lion or a bear would feel like. So what lesson does David learn from these experiences? I think from a young age, he knew that God was with him. He relied on him and had no fear because of his faith in God. And faith and confidence have a way of breeding success. David was well aware that God was working with him and watching over him. And he walked daily in that faith. So when it was tested, he reacted without hesitation. Let us read the full passage in 1 Samuel 17 again, now verses 32 to 37. David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him, attacked him, rescued it from his mouth, and when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." Put another way, David had learned that when faced with a much larger, stronger foe, God was the answer. Unlike all those fighting men who relied on their physical, human skill and were terrified of Goliath, David had learned to look past the immediate intimidation and the expectation of failure. He had years of practice being the little guy, and he prepared him for that encounter in a way that nobody else could understand. You see, underdogs don't succeed by fighting the battles they've been given. They succeed by changing the rules. A dyslexic doesn't succeed by transforming into a fast and accurate reader. Instead, they develop other methods for success, such as improved study skills, note-taking, listening. They try to minimize the need for reading, and if reading is absolutely necessary, then perhaps they learn to remember better, so they won't have to read it again. And when Goliath came forward, he challenged the Israelites to a one-on-one duel, spear armor and shield against spear armor and shield. This was probably a standard approach to battle at the time, champion versus champion. In that battle, Goliath had a massive advantage, and everybody knew it. But David altered the expectations to his advantage. We shouldn't try to meet the world on its own terms. We know we're leaky vessels. We know God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. We don't rely on ourselves, but on God. We don't try to become politically powerful, financially powerful. We don't try to impress the world with our towering intellects or to enter into public debate to convert huge numbers to our beliefs. Instead, we focus on becoming spiritually powerful and increasingly humble. It's an investment that seems foolish to the world now, but we know the rewards to come will be beyond imagining. Let's turn to Gideon. Once again, God chose someone who would not be described as a fighting man. The Israelites at the time had been oppressed by the Midianites and the Amalekites for 7 years. Perhaps Israel wanted to fight back, but they had no trained army and certainly didn't have the numbers needed to defeat a larger, better trained force. We read in Judges 6, the Midianites would come and destroy the harvest as well as livestock, and they were aptly compared to locusts, wreaking havoc across the land. When you think of Gideon, what's the first thing that crosses your mind? Do you only think of his defeat of the huge army? Or do you also think of his uncertainty and questioning of God's will? I've always thought of the story with the fleece as an example of someone who couldn't see or at least firmly trust God's guidance. And yet I had forgotten that he actually had one more sign that God was dealing with him. In Judges, the 6th chapter, verses 11 to 21, I'm going to jump around and summarize. We don't have time to read it all. But Gideon is talking to an angel of the Lord, and he says, "If now I have found favor in your sight, show me a sign it's you who speak with me." And so he prepared a goat and unleavened bread. And the angel said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth." And he did. And the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand, touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire sprang from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. This is more than a wet piece of fleece that maybe was the morning dew. This is unmistakable. So after all that, I found it remarkable to consider that Gideon had his doubts. I understand doubting the fleece a bit better, because we always can conjure up what-if scenarios. Maybe there's a reason this fleece is damp. But after witnessing an angel consume an offering with fire, that is more amazing to me. But despite even those doubts, God saw fit to work with Gideon and to use him as a tool to destroy Israel's oppressors. And we, of course, recall the story, though maybe the numbers have escaped our recollection, so I'll provide a small recap. Gideon called to the fighting men of Israel, and 32,000 men answered his call. We're never told the number encamped against them, but we must assume it to be much, much larger than this, perhaps in the hundreds of thousands. What would the wisdom and strength of man tell us? Certainly that we have no chance and would be doomed to even attempt to fight them. But that's not the lesson God has for us. He instructs Gideon to break the standard rules of engagement. No direct confrontation. In fact, the entire point of reducing the size of Gideon's army is to make very clear they're outmatched and in every way the underdog. Judges 7:2 reads, "The Lord said to Gideon, 'The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand has delivered me.'" So first he sends 22,000 home because they're too afraid, which is probably a good thing. considering how people can act foolishly when they're afraid. They might have botched the plan, made a noise, done something more foolish. But even 10,000 were too many, so we come to the test of drinking from the stream. There's actually a surprising amount of disagreement about what really transpires here, which is outside our scope today, but I encourage you to investigate the drinking from the stream on your own. The critical part is that our 10,000 are now whittled down to a mere 300. This is against hundreds of thousands of Midianites. The only way for success, barring a plague of death directly from God, is for an alternate approach to the battle. And we know, of course, that they approached under cover of dark, blew trumpets, freed their torches, and terrorized the overconfident army into attacking each other and fleeing in disarray, so that Israel was able to easily mop up the remnants. Note that 300 men stand against a great host, not through might of arms, not through a direct approach, not through human dominance of being better or smarter or faster. It's certainly through God's overruling, but it's also through a faith that He is working with them, and in the obedience of doing what they were told, though they must have had many questions and not very many answers. The Apostle Paul's words from 2 Corinthians 12, verses 8 and 9 come to mind. 2 Corinthians 12, 8 and 9. Three times I besought the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But He said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for My power is made perfect in weakness." When faced with the overwhelming might of the adversary, allowed to rule over this present evil world, we have to hold fast to our convictions. We can let our righteous indignation burn when we see mistreatment of our own, or when we see how this fallen world is crumbling under its own weight. When we see that this world worships crass reality celebrities or morally bankrupt superstar athletes, we can let it serve as a reminder to us that the answers aren't now. This is a period of practicing our faith and our obedience despite the distractions. I'm reminded of the way baseball players warm up before they go to bat. For those who are unfamiliar, there's this weighted ring they place around the bat that makes it heavier than usual. And they practice swinging this heavier bat so their muscles adjust to this added resistance. And later, when they remove that weight, their muscles expect the resistance and push accordingly. But with the reduced weight, the bat swings far more freely and faster. Can you imagine our current walk as being like that weighted ring? We walk through this world trying to maintain the proper character, fighting against these temptations and the weakness of the flesh, doing the right thing even when we see those around us rewarded for not doing the right thing. We have to work so hard at it right now, but when that kingdom comes, the weight will be removed. And we'll have had all this practice trying to do the right thing. It will suddenly be easier for us, and our flesh and our spirit will already be trained to the right reflexes and expectations. Just as the underdogs of this present evil world must fight overwhelming force armed only with their anger and their weapons of the Spirit, so we too must fight against the powers of this world using what we call the weapons of the Spirit. We refer, of course, to the whole armor of God, fast found in Ephesians, the 6th chapter, verses 11 through 17. We won't read through that at this time, but again, Ephesians 6, 11 through 17. A discussion of the armor of God warrants an entire talk in its own right, and we don't do it justice here, but we want to highlight that the armor of God is intended as tools for the underdog. If you pay attention specifically to Ephesians 6, verse 12, it reads, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." Doesn't that sound like we're the underdog? Our weapons are truth, righteousness, the gospel of peace, faith, and the word of God. And we must use them with persistence. When we're faced with a trial, do we find it easy to recognize that trial as a learning opportunity? Not always. It's often not our first instinct. But we can train ourselves to recognize those opportunities. At the 2015 General Convention, Brother Rick Sirassi gave an excellent discourse on the space between action and response, and how we, with training, can make sure we opt for the right response, not necessarily the automatic, fleshly response. If we can recognize these trials for what they are, we can divert our energy from reacting to embracing the opportunity and growing from it. Our fleshly tendency is to become discouraged by failure, or even simply by being in a disadvantaged position. it's not really human nature to enjoy being the underdog, being expected to lose, being expected to fail. I'm curious, how many of you have ever played a game of chess? Okay, so a good number of hands. If you have, I think it's safe to say that at least half of you have come up against somebody, or maybe quite a few somebodies, who easily beat you. I don't know about you, but I find it very frustrating. I don't mind when I feel like perhaps I had a chance at some point, but I made maybe a mistake. But when I didn't have a chance, when it's not even close to an even match, to be the underdog, that hopelessness is what really riles me up. Couldn't this perhaps be likened to a witness opportunity? Have you ever tried to witness to somebody who knew the scriptures so much better than you? Do we find that discouraging? Do you feel like you shouldn't even bother because you're no good at it? I know I've been there. Or what about when you study? Do you find that even though you put in a lot of time and effort, you just can't remember the scriptures as well as this brother or that sister? A couple of my oldest friends absolutely put me to shame with their ability to recall not only the right scripture at the right time, but even the proper citation. And yet, should this be a discouragement? Are we to be comparing ourselves to our brethren? Or is this perhaps a cause for us to celebrate the blessings and the talents of our brethren? And better still, can we use this as a carrot to pull ourselves toward greater study and greater opportunities for learning and for service? Recall the underdog we mentioned at the beginning, Gary Cohn. He was able to leverage his apparent weakness into a tool that helped him succeed. Can we do the same with our weaknesses? I've seen this in the classroom numerous times. The student that has to work long hours to achieve academic success learns many other skills along the way, like how to take notes, how to study, how to ask the right questions, and perhaps even how to guess wisely. The student for whom the work comes easy learns none of these things. If I had to choose between the student that just gets it and the student who has to earn it, I would say that the latter student is the one that learns a topic more thoroughly. Similarly, who values something more, the one to whom it's been given, or the one who had to go out and fight for it and earn it? It's not that you can't appreciate what you've been given, but that I think we have a natural tendency to place more value on the fruits of our labor. That student that has to earn it not only learns to work hard, but becomes intimately acquainted with the method. I used to have great students who could pick up a mathematical topic virtually immediately. But if I would ask them to explain the solution to help other students, it became clear they couldn't. I even find myself struggling with this as we homeschool the boys. I have to frequently keep Jamie involved in order to force me to explain things better and in more detail without skipping steps. So how does this help us spiritually again? Well, if we want to truly understand a complex topic, whether it be the sin offering, the covenants, chronology, would a photographic memory help? Can you imagine if every time you were asked a question, you could mentally reference the exact volume, reprint, etc.? That might sound appealing, and yet, would that really mean that you had the understanding? Back to the math classroom. One of the largest pitfalls students face is the temptation to blindly follow and parrot the teacher's own words. I apologize if you've heard me tell this story before, but I was once teaching a math concept between the students and myself, we devised three different methods for obtaining a solution. So a student raises his hand in the back and asks, "Well, which one should I use?" I said, "Use the one that's easiest for you, or the one that makes the most sense for you." He couldn't pick for himself. He said it was too confusing if I didn't tell him which one to use. And yet I don't know what's easiest for a student or what fits best with his understanding. And the problem with following a rule because you're told to follow it is that if you change the circumstances even slightly, what you thought of as knowledge can be lost. True understanding is flexible. Parroting only works for the exact same circumstances. And so if our knowledge of the scriptures is parroting, how do we fare when we come across a thought or evidence that contradicts that particular scripture? If our foundation is inflexible, then a single deviation or question can bring it tumbling down. But if we really grasp the intricacies and interconnections, we have a much more enduring, adaptable, and intimate understanding. Brethren, we're faced daily with the fact that we're underdogs. We're disadvantaged by our fallen condition, and constantly struggling against the adversary while being dragged down by sin. It's in no way a fair fight. So how do we turn this to our advantage? Well, if we have to work harder, we know it's going to stick better. It's going to mean more because it doesn't come easily to us. We don't earn anything through our good works, but we do earn the good habits that we've struggled to adopt. If we make mistakes, they'll help us learn the right way to do things. Gary Cohn wasn't afraid to take a risk hopping into that car that day. He had nothing to lose and everything to gain, and so do we. We've all heard the adage, you can't take it with you. There's no reward for having the most toys or power during this present evil age. There's no prize for impressing those in this world. Instead, we should learn the lessons that our mistakes teach us. We should learn to have less fear of failure. And we should continue to strive for what we're promised in 2 Corinthians 4:17, that our momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. Brethren, we practice daily fighting against the flesh and adopting a loving heart attitude, even towards those that don't show us the same courtesy. And practice is important. Yet another article by the same Mr. Gladwell, can you tell he's a favorite of mine, claims that to master any skill, you must put in at least 10,000 hours of practice. Can we even comprehend how much time 10,000 hours really is? Allow me to put this in perspective for you. If you were to practice something for 4 hours a day for 7 years straight, you would just top 10,000 hours of practice. If, on the other hand, you only practice an hour every day, it would require more than 27 years to become an expert at something. I was actually wondering how accurate that 10,000 hours was, so I quizzed Sister Sarah Lightfoot, who, if you know her, you know she's a wonderful piano player. And after talking to her, we would estimate that she's put in close to 15,000 hours of practice on the piano, which makes sense. And that's probably rounding low. So if you want to be good at something, you need to really devote your life to it. There's no room for just a little bit of time. If you would master chess or the piano, you need to practice it over and over. And keep in mind, that's practicing the little boring stuff, the scales, the chess openings, whatever you will. It's not all minuets and brilliant checkmates. And if we want to be really good at walking in our master's footsteps, we need to practice it every day for our entire lives. We want to be a virtuoso of the Bible. And so we want to remind you not to beat yourself up about your disadvantages. Embrace them as a badge of honor. It's why you were chosen to follow our master, and it's enabled you to recognize the futility of relying on yourself. One of my favorite verses is 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, verses 26 to 29. 1 Corinthians 1, 26 to 29. For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. And base things of the world, and things which are despised, hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. Think of those poor people who currently don't have a hope for a resurrection or the kingdom. They imagine they have but one chance, and they imagine it's all up to them. That would be truly discouraging. Instead of being discouraged, when we suffer setbacks and frustrations, when we feel like the little guy, being pushed around by larger, stronger forces, that's when we need to remind ourselves not only that God is with us, but that he's training us right now to possess the qualities that make us his ideal soldiers and spokespeople. There's this great quote I'd like to share with you. Courage is not something you already have that makes you brave when the tough times start. Courage is what you earn when you've been through the tough times and you discover they aren't so tough after all. Being an underdog can be painful, uncomfortable, uncertain. There are no guarantees for success. In fact, there are many things that can go wrong when you're the little guy. People who conquered dyslexia have gone on to make amazing careers and lives for themselves. But there are many who have not been so fortunate. And even this is to be expected. We all know that many are called, but few are chosen. We know that straight is the way and narrow the gate. So remember the failings of the Davids and the Gideons, and recognize that those failings aren't deal breakers to God. Remember the faith of David, of Gideon, of Joseph. Remember their hard work even when nobody was watching. Remember their patience through trying circumstances and tests of faith, and remember the rewards that came to them. How much greater reward will we have when we're able to serve our master in the kingdom? So I apologize, I skipped through Joseph because we were running short on time. But I would encourage you to consider him as an underdog as well, and look some of that story up again as well. So thank you very much, brethren, and may the Lord add his blessing.